Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Copernic First Quarter 2016 conference call. Today's call is being recorded, and at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ghassan Ghaffar. Please go ahead. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today for the first quarter quarterly conference call. My name is Ghassan Ghaffar, and I have with me Dave Ivan, our CIO and Lead PM for the Global All Cap Strategy. Before I pass it over to Dave for the majority of the call, I would like to give a quick firm update. Since our call around 3 months ago, the firm has continued to grow. We are now 34 people strong, and that includes a new hire recently, which we have brought in to further help our marketing and client services effort. From an AUM standpoint, compared to the beginning of the year, we are currently at $1.8 billion versus $1.6 billion from 3 months ago. That number has grown due to market appreciation, given strong performance of the fund, coupled with the positive net flows during this period. Lastly, Dave will be referring to a presentation during the call, and the link for the presentation and the actual presentation can be found on our website, copernicglobal.com, under the News and Views section. And with that, Dave, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, and thanks everybody for dialing in. The market continues to throw interesting quarters at the markets, a lot going on. When we last talked about 3 months ago, a lot of people were talking about, is this the beginning of a bear market? There was a lot of fear out there. A lot of the fear tends to have passed for the time being. We'll see what the future holds for the main stock indexes. We have no particular opinion. One thing we do have an opinion and have had an opinion, though, is that the big stocks that are dominating the market are not indicative of what's going on in the market. We think, like the early 70s and like the late 90s, big popular stocks have gone one way, while a lot of other stocks have gone the other way. And when people were talking about, is this the beginning of a bear market, we sort of gelled what should have been obvious all along, is that this is really well into a bear market. It's quite possibly the end of a bear market, and whether what we've seen over the last couple of months turns out to be the end of the bear market, we'll see. But bear markets are painful for value investors and for active managers in general. It's been a painful few years. It's been a long bear market. We've talked in the past, a bear market we do not believe to be something so simple as down 20% is a bear market and down 19 is not. We think bear markets are relentless downward move that starts hurting, eventually rips people's spirits out, and people finally give up, and usually leads to changes in psychology. And we've seen that. When we look back, oil, of course, has been famously dropping the last couple of years. But if you look at most other commodities, they've been dropping for 4.5 years, and in some cases 8 to 9 years ago, and even oil peaked back in 2008. Gold, of course, peaked 5 years ago, and emerging markets peaked 4.5 years ago. Uranium peaked about 10 years ago. And so looking at lots of assets, lots of resources, and lots of markets, most developed markets are down on a 5-year basis, and most emerging markets are down substantially on a 4 or 5-year basis. So we don't know if it's the end of that bear market. We know for sure it's not the beginning. Down 50 to 90% over many years' time, that's deep into the bear market. And the quote we're showing, bear markets make people a lot of money, they just don't know it at the time. If it's painful as a few months ago, or it was the beginning of, we don't know if this is the real move or not, but over the long term, there should be massive money made as a result of good properties being discounted by 90%. On that note, we've done a lot of means over the last year, and the question that comes up over and over is, when are things going to turn? People generally tell us everybody knows value is going to come back someday. Everybody knows emerging markets will come back someday. Everybody knows that commodities are cyclical and will come back someday. But what's the catalyst? When is this going to happen? And we understand all of us have career risk. But in terms of risk to the portfolio, we think timing is less important than just being in great scarce properties that are down 80 or 90%. We've talked about and we'll continue to talk about what Warren Buffett did during the last market that was like this. In 68, 69, he closed his fund, sent everybody their money back, kept Berkshire, of course, but his main fund he sent back. From then on, the index seemed to be flat, but within that, the Nifty 50 had gone up and almost everything else went down. They went down so much that in late 73, he famously started buying stocks like crazy, so he's like a kid in a candy store. And the timing, of course, if you look at the chart, was great. The chart we're showing here, you can see things are up 10 times. He's made a lot of money. It would have, I don't know what it was like for him this first year or so, though, because in the first three quarters, things went down by another third. So in the short-term world we live in now, he would have been under tremendous pressure. It's not fun losing 20-30% of your money in three quarters' time, but that's exactly what happened to him. You can look at their read through their annual statements. Since then, he made a lot of money. Now, if he had tried to time it and timed it perfectly, his future returns would have been better by 1% a year. That is meaningful. However, if he missed it, he left massive, massive money on the table. When you get a chance to buy great franchises that are down in the depths of a bear market, it's better to be early, we think, and suffer a little bit of pain than to miss out on it. That's where we are now. Opportunities to buy scarce resources that really can't be replicated at really, really attractive prices. Now, sometimes if you're early, there's opportunity cost. In the current world, there's not even opportunity cost. People can put their money in the bank and get zero, and in Europe, they can get negative rates sometimes. Who could have imagined a world where we get negative returns on cash balances? People can go out the curve and get slightly positive nominal yields. Undoubtedly, will still be negative real yields. Time will tell. The Fed has reasons, I guess, to keep rates low, but there's unintended consequences. As savers, all of us get no return on our savings, and taking punishing savers and rewarding borrowers, that gets unintended consequences. Another consequence, of course, is volatility. People don't seem to like volatility. It is what it is, but we think in the effort to get rid of risk, the central banks have increased risk in addition to increasing volatility, which we don't consider to be risk. But anyhow, the volatility has provided an opportunity to buy things pretty cheap. That's, an interesting opportunity. Now, where to go? Most people are buying bonds and high-quality stocks. That's what's worked over the last 5 years. Following the crowd works quite often. In the long run, it does not. In order to have superior performance, especially at inflection points, it's better to be a little different. As far as different, it usually is long-term cycles. Things slowly go down, 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 and get very, very cheap. Then they go up for a long time. In between, there's no real reason to have strong opinions. At extremes, there is. You can see on this chart here, healthcare once was less than 5% of the index. When it tripled over the next few decades, was a good time to hit the exit. It went into a bear market. Now they've run up to similar levels to where they were at the last top. Probably a dangerous time to be in healthcare. Similar with technology. But interestingly enough, people will say, well, there's been a big run in emerging markets or a big run in gold or materials in the last couple of months. Is that it? Who knows, but probably not. You'll notice the materials part of the index has gone from 14% to less than 3%. Almost none of the index is in materials. This little run that we've seen is but a blip. Similar thing with energy, 27% of the index. That's on the decade peak. It got to 33%, I think, at some point in time around there. A third of the index in energy. Now it's less than 7%, so very, very little capital invested in energy, quite a contrast from a few years ago. So off to the right, energy, materials, telecom, utilities, some of these things, despite an overall fairly heftily valued market, these industries are a small part of the index. They've been underinvested in, which bodes well, and they're pretty cheap. With that in mind, shouldn't be a shock that our portfolio is more invested in the areas that have been falling for a lot of years and become cheap, and there's not much exposure to the industries and sectors and countries that have had the big runs. Those of you that have known us have come to expect that. What does that mean? It means that we're able to put together a portfolio of industry-leading companies at valuations that are a lot less than the market. And to own dominant companies in growing areas of the world for 11 times earnings and 4 times cash flow and 60% of book value, that's something that doesn't come along every day. To show you the sort of mismatch and the top 10 constituents of the all-country world index, 9 of the 10 are in the United States. I don't know how they do the indexes, but Google doesn't even make this list. But even without that, notice 9% of the whole index just in these 10 companies. It's also fairly interesting that for 1 extra percent, somebody could buy most of the world. By that, I mean the emerging markets. The emerging markets, of course, are half the world's GDP, and 6 out of 7 billion of the people in the world, most of the growth in the world, most of the resources in the world, someone can own all that for not much more than what the 10 popular companies are going for. Fascinating opportunity. Of course, we've shown this to you other ways, Apple versus Russia or Brazil, and they, in the past I've seen presentations of Intel versus India and things like that. So here we are, able to buy most of the world for about the valuation of the top 10 or 11 companies. That, I think, is interesting. Within this environment, we haven't done a whole lot. We've held on to what we think is good. There has been opportunities to do a few things, though. You did have a complete capitulation of stocks back in January. That did allow us to buy the first oil company in the U.S. that we've owned in many, many years with Marathon. We've recently been buying dry bulk tankers that stocks are down 90%. We can buy tankers for small fraction what it costs to build the tanker. So the latest additions, Golden Ocean, uranium we've had for 3 years now, continue to love the fundamentals. We were able to buy some Denison Mining, very small. And the oil also, we had to do MEG. Pandora, we've talked about, that got cheaper. We were able to buy more. Within the gold space, some of the ones that ran up, we trimmed a little and rolled it into some of the quality names, and we will get to that in a moment. But first, gold has this run from 1,050 to 1,250. Is that something people should be worried about, that the move has happened? There's a lot of ways of looking at gold. We talk about the incentive cost of production being around $2,000. Dollars an ounce, and if it's a commodity, that's probably where it will get eventually. If it's money, You can see here the supply of money compared to the price of gold. You can see gold trends up and stays above it right now relative to the money supply. Gold is the cheapest it's ever been, or was 2 months ago. Arguably, gold can go way, way higher from here, ought to under any economic way of looking at it. But within that, the problem for a lot of people is the quality of the managements and the quality of some of the companies. We agree with that. That's why we've insisted upon buying the companies at very good prices and staying very diversified. We didn't expect a world where we could buy the really high-quality companies, the streaming companies that loan money to projects and get the revenues without worrying about the cost problems and the risks associated with mining. They always sell at a premium. But what we saw in December, January is a complete capitulation of natural resources and gold, and the quality names became very, very cheap. So we now have a decent position in silver, Wheaton, and Royal Gold. We were happy to have that opportunity. So gold's really good, uranium's really good, but also around the world, and especially in the growing areas of the world, we are happy to own hydroelectric power and nuclear power and wind farms and agricultural farms and railroads and planes and all of these things at a fraction of what it takes to build these franchises. So in a world where somebody can own cash or bonds that yield effectively nothing, or own great franchises that have tremendous wealth and buy them at a fraction of the price, we think this bodes very well for the future. So wanted to keep the formal part of the presentation very cheap and spend most of the time on Q&A in what is a very interesting period of time.
And if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. And if you're joining us on a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 for a question. And we will take our first question today from Rick Spidell with Ameriprise. Please go ahead.
Thank you. You didn't touch on coal very much, but the recent filing this week, I was wondering if you could comment on that, if there will be anybody standing when it's all over. And then if you would comment on two Canadian holdings, the Meg Energy, which you said you added to, and also Dundee.
Certainly. The coal question we knew was on the way. We were even going to put it in the presentation, but I figured we could count out. Let's answer that in two ways. First, we do not think that coal is obsolete. We don't think it's going the way of the buggy whip. We think that other technologies are coming on, and market share will be gained by solar and gained by wind and gained by gas. But 53% of the world's electricity coming from coal right now, and coal being abundant and a very efficient way to generate electricity, and the fact that China and India and Indonesia and places like that that need lots of energy have lots of coal, it's not going away, and but it will decline. What you've had now in a lot of areas, coal being one of them, is you had a sort of bubble in China a while back. Demand was too high. Now there's been what always happens after bubbles, the collapse on the other side of it. So demand is very low. And that's always hard on everybody, but a lot of these companies borrowed too much money at the top of the cycle, and now they're paying the price at the bottom of the cycle. Coal, not going away. Eventually we'll go higher in price. The companies will do well. But a lot of damage has been done. The whole industry is down 90-some-odd%, and a lot of them are bankrupt. Now, up until recently, we thought, well, at least we've avoided the guys that went bankrupt. We can't say that. Now we had what was once a meaningful position in Peabody. We have maintained and continue to be maintained that there's a lot of wealth in Peabody, that despite the massive debt they have and the negative cash flow and the problems, that the value of their assets is many times the value of their debt. We think that going bankrupt was unnecessary, even stupid on their part. But they've done it, so we've been wrong on that particular name. However, I think it's important to look at the strategy that we've always gone with. We've always thought the market's not entirely efficient when it hates things. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. If we do our own appraisal, we find that we can be right much more often than we can be wrong, but we're still wrong plenty of times, believe me. If we lose money when we're wrong, but we make money a lot more often, and we make good money when we're right, that's worked out very well. 2008, 2009, some of you were invested with us then. You'll remember that we had a similar strategy in energy and also in mining. Bought a lot of companies that were trading at 10 cents on the dollar. Crystal X and Apex Silver went under, and we lost money on these. But since we were buying a diversified portfolio at 10 cents on the dollar, we had stocks go up four times, five times. In Papua New Guinea, it went up seven times. In Mongolia, it went up 10 times. So the result was that we made quite a bit of money. Same thing here. Now we've been in natural resources. It's been a tough time for natural resources, one of the toughest times ever. Peabody was a very frustrating investment for all of us. Some of the other investments have been tough also. Fortunately, we bought all these things at 10 cents on the dollar, and so why Peabody has cost us a lot of money, Consol has just doubled, and then 2.5 times, a lot of the other resource companies are starting to go up quite a bit. So while we're not proud of Peabody, we are satisfied with our diversified portfolio underwrite. We looked over the last 12 months. The last 12 months, the all-country world index is down. Our portfolio is up quite a bit over that time, and in 2/3 of those gains are on resources. So even including Peabody in that mix, the important loss on Peabody and a few other names, our resources were up nicely over the last, so not just versus the market, up in a down market, while the resources in the index went down. So resources went down, our resources went up, and that's despite the fact that a lot of them went down. There's just a lot more went up, and they went up by a lot. So, you know, that's neither good or bad. I'm just trying to explain the strategy. It's worked in the past. We think it will continue to work. Our goal is never to say we can find things at 10 cents on the dollar and the market's never right. There's reasons things sell at 10 cents on the dollar. Our goal is to be right more often than we're wrong and to diversify it. That has been the strategy. That continues to be the strategy. Elsewhere, we've had a name in India that didn't work out that well. We had MEG that you've brought up, and that's of course one of the higher cost producers. With oil sands are more expensive than other places. We waited till that fell a lot before we bought it. It fell more after, so not been a winner. But that's coming back strongly now. Last time I think we did the call, we said we aren't experts on oil, but we can all but guarantee that 28 is the wrong price for oil. Now the price is over 40. That's still, I think, the wrong price of oil. Oil will settle out higher. I don't know whether it has more downdrafts, and I don't know how long it takes to get there. But if we can buy companies that are better positioned, they don't have to be super well positioned, better positioned than others that can make it through the cycle. The cycles have not been eliminated. The central banks of the world have not gotten rid of cycles. They've made cycles worse. If we can find companies like MEG that are able to make it through the cycle, tremendous value in a name like that. If we look at the value of the reserves they have, so we continue to like that one. Dundee, in a way, is not a resource or energy play, but in a way it is. You would think something like Canadian real estate is very different, but the market right now, even more than normal, treats everything as highly correlated. So, the whole country of Russia is considered merely an oil play, and Canadian real estate seems to be considered an oil play right now. And so one of their problems is that they have a lot of Canadian real estate. They have a gold company that's bounced back quite a bit, so that's a positive. They have oil properties in Africa. That's not worth a lot right now, and they're holding back their expenses. But this is a company and a family that over the years have had a knack for buying things cheaply. This company's trading at less than half of what we think the company could be liquidated at. So, smart family managing a diverse group of assets, many of which are not liked by the market right now. We see challenges, but we also see a lot of value.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Scott Feldstein with Morgan Stanley.
Hi, David. I guess two questions. What is your longer-term outlook on oil prices and where you feel the price longer-term should be? And what is your risk of recession here in the United States in the year to two-year time frame? Do you see a risk?
Okay. On longer-term price of oil, we don't make pinpoint predictions, and we certainly don't try to time anything. That's not our forte. We do believe in the long run economics plays out. We think the cost of what it takes to pull oil out of the ground or gold out of the ground, uranium out of the ground is interesting, but longer term what's important is what we call the incentive price. So that's if you're pulling a barrel out of the ground, you got to go find new oil someplace else and find it and develop it and all the expense of doing that. What price would that take? And we believe it's in the vicinity of $75. Now, we won't argue with $65. We won't argue with $85. Don't even know if we'd argue with $60. But $75 is the number that we think it would take to sustainably bring on supply as fast as what's being consumed. So we think 75 plus or minus 15 bucks is something you see in the next 2-3 years. Similarly, we think the price to bring on new gold mines, not existing ones, new gold mines, is in the vicinity of 2,000 per ounce. We think the price it takes to bring uranium out of the ground for new mines, coincidentally, is also right around $75. And so that's the way we look at a lot of commodities. And if the market differs by a little bit, we don't pay much attention. If the market gets way away from these values, we do pay a lot. Terms of recession, we never factor that in. We don't pay much of any attention into that. But we do also believe the government statistics, they're probably a lot better here than they are in China, but that doesn't mean they're good here. You're taking people's guesses on what the economy is growing at, and whether somebody even wants to buy in on the idea that Keynesian idea that consumption is what we're after instead of production. We don't necessarily buy off on that, or that is consumer spending, GDP, is government spending actually creating wealth? Then, of course, you subtract from that the inflation rate. And the inflation rate that the governments calculate, we think, are nothing remotely approximating the cost of living increases over time. So we think that right now the economy is not doing all that well and hasn't for years. We think that the massive debt overhang of most of the Western world and a lot of Asia now too means that we've lived beyond our means for decades now. So over the next 20 years, we would predict that any model assuming high growth should be doubted. The future is probably lower growth than the past. So our portfolio tends to not have a lot of companies that require a lot of economic growth. So we're not factoring in anything particularly good or particularly bad happening to the U.S. economy or the world. The world will muddle along. It'll do fine. And we're going to spend most of our time looking bottom-up appraisal of companies.
Is there anything else, Scott?
No, thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Gary Magnuson with Morgan Stanley.
Hi, Dave. Gary Magnuson. Just curious, what do you think of Apple? It looks like you own Samsung. I know Apple's on that top 10 constituents list, but was curious how you look at it valuation-wise. And then I had one question on one of your charts.
Okay. Yeah, no, we don't currently own Apple or Samsung at the moment, but Samsung something in the past we've looked at. On both of them, they're very interesting in a lot of ways. On traditional valuation metrics, they're actually quite attractive, and they're both pretty dominant companies. Well, what's not to like? Not much, with one exception. We spend a lot of time looking at margins, and we say, how do those margins compare with how other companies and those businesses have done over decades? And consumer electronics, I'm 58 years old. I've seen the Sony Walkman come along ago. I've seen DVDs get hot and they're gone, and CDs and 8-track tapes, and then different types of phones, and everybody has to have a BlackBerry, and then nobody wants a BlackBerry, and margins are high, and then they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. If you put an average consumer electronics company margin on either of these two companies, they're outrageously expensive. If you take a look at how they've done the last 10 years, then they're incredibly cheap. So we've decided to go with, we're not smart enough to figure this out, and we'll sit on the sidelines and watch, and we'll root for Apple, a great American company, but we don't own it.
Great. Thanks for your insight. Can you comment on your monetary base versus spot price of gold in terms of the definition of monetary base? And is that like all currencies or all value, or what is that? How do you talk when you have that gold and chart?
Yeah. This is the sort of thing where you can get a lot of people to have all kinds of different definitions of what money is. For thousands of years, gold's been money. So let's say gold is a form of money. Then there's dollars, and there's yen, and there's euros. And there's similar charts to this for yen and yuan that look a lot worse than this. And then there's the euro that actually looks a little better than this. But this is just the dollar. And so historically, gold was money in the United States, and the government issued dollars, and those dollars were convertible into gold. So when you held a dollar, you were effectively holding gold. And that gold, if you took $20.67, you could buy an ounce of gold. Then, 1933, Franklin Roosevelt said, well, we're changing it from 10.67 to 35. So that was a I guess effectively a massive bout of money printing may change the value of the dollar relative to gold. That was fixed for a long time. Famously, in 1971, Nixon said, we're not going to honor this anymore. Dollar used to be representative of interest in gold. From 1971 forward, the dollar is indicative of interest in nothing. It represents absolutely nothing other than what people psychologically think it's worth. But if you go to supply and demand, it makes sense that, just like they taught us in Econ 101, that if there's supplies of apples and supplies of oranges, and then all of a sudden the supply of oranges goes up 10 times, that the value of apples relative to oranges has changed. It's going to change. And so it makes sense that even though we're not officially on a gold standard, the U.S. still owns the gold. And if you increase the value of dollars out there, theoretically, they should lose purchasing power. In reality, they lose purchasing power. And since 1971, the dollar has lost 80-some-odd percent of its purchasing power. Generally, if one looks at the amount of money versus the amount of gold, as the money supply goes up, the price of gold goes up. And it can do with a lag, and there can be cyclicality to it, and it doesn't correlate perfectly any one year or another, but over time it does. And it was really correlating really nice. And then in 2011, the amount of money being printed went straight to the moon. Everybody expected the price of gold would go straight to the moon with it. Instead, it went straight down 40% over 4 years. That's an odd thing. Now, the other part was just base money. So the Federal Reserve, they own assets and they issue currency against that. That's base money. That's just simple money that's put out by the Central Reserve. And then that can go into the banks, and then banks are allowed to create money on top of that. So then there's M1, which is, you know, has demand deposits plus currencies, and then there's M2 that adds more to it, and M3 that adds more to it. All those are theoretically forms of money, but they're really forms of credit. So usually when the M2s and 3s are accelerating, that means the economy is getting more leverage. Usually when they're accelerating, the economy accelerates, and prices of things that are bought with that accelerate. But you can get a lot of different opinions, but to us, base money is, well, I guess this is base, that's money that's not leveraged, it's not created by banks. And so as more of that is printed, that is theoretically inflation. Then how fast that gets into the economy, then that's the M2s and 3s, and people will divide that by the base money to give you the multipliers. The multipliers affect when it's getting in the economy. They affect their transmission mechanisms, if you will. So when you have times where credit's expanding but money supply not, then certain forms of assets do pretty well. When you have times like 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, when the Federal Reserve's creating lots of money out of thin air, but it's not being leveraged, it's not going to the economy, times like that is when the price of gold follows the base money creation, and prices of leveraged assets like real estate and stocks and bonds sometimes tend to lag. And so if and when they start printing money again, and of course a lot of the world is printing money, that's when you see gold do better than leveraged assets. And when the economy is loving leverage again, leveraged assets do better than gold. Trying to predict if and when leverage picks up, that's tough, other than to say it's out there in the the press very late to read the complications of the current debt load. So, if the current debt load continues to be problematic and we have to continue with low interest rates and negative interest rates, quite likely they will print a lot more money. And if I had to guess, I'll guess they'll print more money. But the important thing here is, even if I'm wrong, the price of gold is vastly lagged the money creation that's already happening. So they don't need to print any more money. The price of gold could arguably go up way, way higher just to catch up with the money. Also, just to reiterate, throw all this stuff out, just the incentive price argues the price of gold should go higher. And most importantly, if everything I've just said is completely off base, the gold mining stocks, we believe, are too cheap, even if gold stays right where it is. So there is a lot of reasons to think the upside is substantial on gold miners, and the downside is probably limited.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Mary Ann Johnson with Johnson Custom Strategies. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask about Peabody, but I think you already answered the question.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. And if anyone else finds that their question has been answered and they'd like to remove themselves from the queue, press star 2. And we have one name remaining at this time. So as a reminder, please press star 1 if you have a question. We'll go to Scott Treese with FEPAIR. Please go ahead.
Thank you. And, Dave, thank you for the call. Please forgive the kind of prospective investor question here. We're not that familiar with your portfolio, but I have a two-pronged question. Number one, do you or are you allowed to hedge in any way in your portfolio derivatively, whether that be shorts of the broad market, particularly hedging back any non-U.S. dollar exposures, how you handle that, or even if you could go to, say, UltraTees in the futures market to put on some 30-year long-duration exposure. And then the second part of the question, Dave, would be we do in our firm have a view towards a impending U.S. recession, and we also have a view toward a very, let's just call it pregnant with triplets, valuation multiples in the headline U.S. equity indices. If, in fact, a recession were to occur, and if, in fact, we would have mean reversion back down to more normal levels, which would seem to indicate at least a 40% type of a drop, can you give us some general idea what your expectation would be on performance, as difficult as I know that is, so please feel free to give us all kinds of caveats and whatnot. But just in general, given the fact that you really do have a very deep value, mean reversion type portfolio put together in many different places like your gold miners and whatnot, just a feel for what your expectation might be were we to see the S&P drop, you know, 40% over the next year or 18 months. Thank you.
Sure. Now, those are very good questions. So I guess this will be – I'll try to keep the answer short, but it won't be that short. Let's see. If we start with the U.S. So we love the U.S. We've always lived here, a great country. It's going to do well for a long, long time. When it comes to stocks, it's not about that. It's all about value. Value is everything. And so we point out to people that in 1929, the U.S. was poised to do really well for the next 80 years. It's just that it was a very bad time to buy stocks. They fell 90%. 1972, 1987, 1999, 2007, they were all times where investors were about to lose half their money in U.S. stocks, despite the fact that the U.S. continued to be a wonderful country. So we have less money invested in the U.S. now than we ever have, really, despite the fact we still love the country. How do we get there? Not by making any prediction on the U.S., but by every analyst looking for value. Our railroad analyst 10 years ago found lots of value in U.S. railroads. When they went up a lot, we started finding more value in Japanese railroads. When they ran up, now we find value in Chinese railroads. We used to find a lot of value in U.S. utilities, and then we started finding value in European utilities. Now we're finding value in Brazilian and Russian utilities. We used to find value in U.S. drug companies when Obama was elected, and then we found more value in Europe, and now we don't find any value in drug companies. They're great companies, but and so on and so forth. So industry by industry, we have found ourselves migrating elsewhere. So we love the U.S. We just agree with you that the U.S. market is higher. There are times like 2007 where the U.S. market's kind of expensive, and we look around and we look at all sectors and all stocks and all countries, and we find relative value but not a lot of compelling value. I mentioned earlier on in the early 70s, the market was outrageously expensive on the surface, but that's just because of the Nifty 50. Underneath it all were massive, huge, huge discounts, and Warren Buffett and others took advantage of that. In 1999, the market was outrageously expensive. Underneath it all, people were giving away old economy names and bricks and mortar names and small value names, and they were so cheap that many of us were able to make a lot of money in 2000, 2001, 2002, even as the popular stocks came crashing down. And we don't know the future, but we do know the present. The present is that in a market that's pretty expensive on the surface, once you dig below the surface, we find that markets are down 50 to 80% in places like Brazil and Russia and some of the other emerging markets. And we find that oil stocks are pretty cheap and gold stocks are outrageously cheap. And we're finding in different areas phone companies and agricultural companies and you name it. And so we have a portfolio now that's only 60% of book value. And these are of generally market-dominant companies, and so we believe that right now is a really good time to be invested in good businesses around the world. But some, and we think also that just like the late 90s, we're coming off a period where active management's been just a horrible thing then, and we believe now that portends well for active management, because active managers right now can own these things that are not part of the hugely overvalued ETFs and indexes. So a beautiful time to be independent thinking active manager. That's self-serving, but I think that the facts support that view. If we're willing to hold things for the long term, and we're worried about not permanently losing capital, but less worried about volatility, that allows us to buy less popular companies, and it also allows us to go unhedged. And so hedging does take out volatility. Beyond that, we're not sure it adds any value. We think if we're buying things that inherently have value and are going to create wealth over time, that wealth translates into into value in all currencies over time. So we're looking for things that have real value as opposed to just nominal value. That's point one. Two, if we were to hedge, I'm not sure that we'd be all that good at it. Three, if we decided to hedge and we were that good at it, still not sure what we should hedge, because different businesses act different ways, and we do spend a lot of time saying, all right, we don't own stocks, we own businesses, and if we own an oil well, it's not exposed to currencies, but if we own an import company, it is exposed to currencies. If we own a resource company, we actually want the currency to drop because then costs drop relative to the dollar price of the goods that are sold. And so we own companies that are resource companies and non-resource companies. We have exporters, we have importers, we have lots of global companies that produce everywhere and sell everywhere. It would be very, very complicated to get the hedging right, so we're not going to. Also, over the decades, the dollar usually does fall against most other currencies. And lastly, if our clients want to put their own hedge on, they can do that, so we don't need to. Those people who want the non-dollar exposure are getting it, and others can hedge back. So, yeah, it is a difficult, more volatile than ever currency world, but we, for all those reasons, don't hedge.
Okay, the only thing, Dave, you didn't mention there is, are you allowed at all to go into any fixed income, U.S. Treasuries, other than just, you know, your normal cash levels?
We are allowed to. At predecessor firms, we from time to time have done that. I ran bonds for a while back in the 90s, 80s, 80s, I guess. And but ever since then, we have bought bonds not to make a prediction on how they're going to do versus stocks. We view ourselves as investors looking to add value. If we do our homework on a company and our modeling suggests that we're going to make 12% a year owning that, and someone comes along and says the bonds of that same company are paying 14% a year, we've done that. We owned a lot of bonds in the early 90s in the aftermath of Drexel. We owned a lot of bonds in 02. We owned a lot of bonds in 08. And a few months ago, we were actually starting to look at a few bonds again. We didn't think we'd ever see the day when they would get, you know, they would get cheap again. Sovereign bonds in the developed world, we have no interest in at this particular time. One, they're less likely to be mispriced, but two, we know that all the central banks admit to openly managing them to higher prices than they deserve, i.e. lower interest rates than they deserve, so you'll probably, you know, never say never, but you'll probably never see us owning sovereign bonds, but up to 10% of the portfolio could be in corporate bonds that get mispriced and offer us equity-type returns. That's the important thing. If you see bonds, it'll be because we think we're going to get equity-type returns. So it is possible.
Great. Thank you.
Next is Jonathan Papp with Wells Fargo Advisors.
Hi, Dave. Just wanted to ask a question. I noticed on one of the slides there were some increases and decreases. And we talked about the gold miners, or you talked about the gold miners being very inexpensive. And I guess I'm just looking to get some insight to what your thoughts were when you decreased, say, Gold Corp and Silver Standard and increased Royal Gold and Silver Wheaton.
Okay, great question. As an aside, the most we can ever put in one industry is 25%. This is my 35th year in the business. There's been three times that we've gone as high as 25% in industry. In 2002, we went from zero in technology to 25%. And in late 2008, we went to 25% in the miners. A few months later, they had bounced, and we had sold a lot of them. Here, it's been, sadly, 3 years that we've been 25% in the miners. They are very, very cheap. We have stayed at 25 and well until they start selling at more reasonable values. So we've stayed there, and we have not added to because our risk controls won't let us, nor have we subtracted to based on valuation. What we have done, and this has been quite helpful, We look at things relative to what we think their risk-adjusted intrinsic value is. If we have two stocks that are trading at what we think is a 70% discount to what they're worth, and one of them runs up to where it's only a 50% discount, while another one goes to an 80% discount, we'll trim a little bit of one and we'll move it to the other. What we've seen happen at various times over the last few years, we've seen people like the small ones better, so then we buy more of the gold corps. Then we see the small one get killed, and then we'll trim a gold corp and buy more of a small one. We've seen big aversion to places like Kyrgyzstan, and then we buy a little more Centera. When that runs up, we trim that and go back into the other ones. And then what's happened that we didn't think we would ever see is we had gold, you know, Royal Gold and Silver Wheaton, two companies that are well run that have exposure to gold through royalty streams without the problems that gold mines have, without exposure to chemistry risk and geology risk and geopolitical risk. And so they've always sold at a premium. But when those just the massive capitulation, when those things got killed, we thought, what a great opportunity to buy these. And we bought them. And we, despite the fact that we still very much like Gold Corp and Silver Standard, we liked Royal Gold and Silver Wheaton more. And so, we made a place for them in the portfolio without taking the portfolio above, 25%. So that was the logic there.
Now, with the Royal Gold, you know, one of the things that did happen is one of the companies that they were funding money to, I guess they did find that they were going to be finding less gold than was predicted. So in some respects, do these companies also do have some exposure to, you know, the companies that they invest in actually finding the amount of gold, right? I mean, there is some truth to that. And this particular stock got hit pretty hard. But the March 10th date that you have, is that when you reported data, or was that when you actually did the purchase?
That should be the trade date.
That's the actual trade date?
Yes. And to your point, they, and that would be the trade date, the last one. A lot of these were bought over time. So we might have started buying it a month before that. And so we'll put it on the trading desk and we'll buy. And a lot of our purchases get done over time, so we could find all the different trade dates if that would be helpful. But there are always little trims and ads going on day after day on the trading desk. That's true. And your other point's good. I did not mean to imply that there's not risk for these guys. There's plenty of risk for these guys. It's just way less risk. And then there's the perception of the risk, too, because where they do have exposure to whether more or less gold is found, and they do have counterparty risks and those sort of things. They don't have the risk of cost creep, which is a big one. They don't have risk of management of the underlying company doing a dilutive share acquisition. They don't have risk of, they have a lot less risk of whether the governments want a bigger royalty or that sort of thing. So there's a reason they've traded at a nice premium. With this one also, while they all have risk, during the complete capitulation, we think the market was taking news about some of their smaller exposures and making it seem like the problems were with some of their big exposures. And we think the news was way overdone. But, yes, there's plenty of risk with all stocks, including this one. It's just less so than most any other mining company.
So certainly the ones that you decreased doesn't mean that they're not cheap also. It just means you might have found opportunities like the Royal Gold that was, you know, that created itself just to make a little bit of a swap, just like anything, just like a good stock picker would.
Yeah, absolutely. We were 25% gold before this. We were 25 after this. And we still own gold, corp, and silver standard, just a little less to make room for these new ones.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for all you do. I think much like you do and have been through pain much like we have with all this things. But I do believe, you know, especially, you know, you've lived through it. I'm living through it. And I'm waiting for that day when you start to really reap the rewards like we're starting to see now, which is good. So
yeah,
thank God.
It's quite an experience. Thank you.
All right. God bless.
And as a reminder, if your question has been answered and you would like to remove yourself from the queue, press star 2. And if you have a question, press star 1. We'll take the next question from Hayden Cole with Essex Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for taking my question. I really respect what you've done with your portfolio, and thanks for giving us the update on your increases and decreases in the Q1. I know we'd see them in the filing or on Bloomberg, but still, it's nice to hear what you have to say about these names. I was just kind of thinking more and more about your discipline and how you allocate across the globe, and maybe I'm speculating too much when I think about certain depressed valuations, but I just wondered what your comments would be on kind of the Southern European and maybe especially like kind of the Mediterranean financials, and maybe especially if you would comment on Greece, because it seems to me like there's a interesting relationship between value and speculation in this particular story, and that at a certain point in time there's a price where the, you know, the non-performing loans and the recapitalization and the whole scenario with it, managing that those bad credits and their balance sheet does get sorted out and things perhaps clear up. I just wonder what your comments are about sort of, we'll say, non-performing financials in Europe.
Yeah, at the beginning, we had a quote from John Templeton, one of our favorites. Another quote of his is, people are always asking where do things look good, and the right question is, where do things look bad, where are there challenges? And so, I like where your question's going. We tend to think that where there are problems is where we're more likely to find a good company. To quickly go over process, you can call us later to get more because I'm sure that most people have heard it, but we're always looking bottom up for companies. We spend most of our time understanding supply, demand, porters, forces, the key drivers of the business, the right way to value it, but then we risk adjust. We want a bigger margin of safety for questionable management or questionable assets or lack of barrier entry. And then we say we might want a bigger discount in Brazil than we want in Canada, or we might want a bigger discount in Greece than we want in Germany. And so we do all that. And then when it comes through, we find sometimes when companies have problems, we want a big discount, and the market gives us an even bigger discount. And so when it was proverbially hitting the fan a number of years ago, we did buy OPAP in Greece, and in Italy we bought the phone company, and we bought ERG, was a refiner, now a wind farm. And we always are on the lookout for values, and when people really didn't like Southern Europe, we were spending a lot of time there, and there still are some values there. So we kind of like the question, and we agree with you. Now, another thing is, how much of a discount do we want for challenge companies? Another question is, how much of a discount do we want for banks? Now, we love banks, but we're not as confident on businesses that are levered 9-to-1 as we are on the railroad, say. And so we want big discounts on banks as well. and you combine the two, we want really big discounts. And historically, when we've owned banks, it's been dominant banks in emerging markets, or it's been dominant banks in Japan, or things like that. Right now, the only bank we own in the whole world is Bear Bank, one of the most dominant banks you'll ever find. We would have trouble getting really comfortable with banks in Greece, just because it's harder for us to analyze, not because we don't like them. So we would need a very big discount, but it's possible. But to be back investing in Greece or any of Southern Europe, absolutely, we're always looking for value wherever it is. And so, no, very good question.
Thanks, David. Thank you.
And we'll go back to Gary Magnuson with Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you'd give us an update on, though I know it doesn't really matter, it's based on value and where you find the best equities to purchase, but how much is in U.S. and how much is outside of U.S., and then maybe state some of the exposures by country, if you could, to give us an update. And then a final question, do you own any coal bonds or anything like that? Thanks.
Right now we own no bonds. We like the coal bonds. We like the coal equities better, and they're volatile right now. Consol's doing really well, and Peabody's doing really poorly. But, yeah, we like the coal bonds. We like the coal stocks. But right now don't own any bonds. Country by country, it gets there from the bottom up. Analyst by analyst is looking for where the value are. It probably wouldn't be a surprise to anybody that after 4 or 5 years of falling relentlessly that we're finding lots of value in emerging markets. So emerging markets are a third of our portfolio. There's also been a relentless, brutal bear market in uranium and gold and related names. A lot of the great gold mining companies in the world happen to be located in Canada, as do the uranium companies. And so we have not quite a third of our portfolio, 29% I think is in Canada right now. Japan is 12% of the portfolio. It got as high as 25% 3.5 years ago before the Abe election sent stocks up 100%. The U.S. is about as low as it's ever been. Like I say, we love the country, but the stock market's had quite a 6.5 year run. Margins are not only high, margins are double normal. There's probably nowhere to go but down on the margins, and so 11% of the portfolio in the U.S. So nice to have a third in the growing parts of the world right now. That's it's nice to see them at those sort of valuations. And so that's where we are.
Thank you.
We'll go to Dan Gallagher with UBS.
Hi, Dave. Thanks again for the call. Question for you. I know that we're, you know, shopping from a list of things that are compressed and slammed, you know, pretty hard already. But if we are in one of these global deflationary, you know, worlds and these interest rates reflect something maybe in the future instead of just pure manipulation, are being centered in materials and industrials and the kind of equities that we have, are these, you know, sectors that, you know, historically have done okay in a deflationary environment?
Let's look at this in several different ways, I guess. Inflation, deflation, what we have now is central banks pouring money into the system, which is clearly massively inflationary. Then we have a huge debt load that's threatening to collapse, which would be a massive deflationary event. And so the world wants to deflate, and the central banks think that they can create inflation. 2003, Ben Bernanke famously said, we have a printing press. Of course, we can create inflation, to paraphrase. It was a long thing he said. But if I had to bet, central banks will win. But that's just as an aside. Let's look at more important, the specifics. On the surface, we have a lot of materials and industrials, and so we maybe need inflation. Below the surface, we don't have much of anything that the normal person would think of as material or industrials. We have no chemicals, and we have steel. We don't have aluminum. We don't have metal bending companies. We don't have much of anything that needs inflation or needs economic growth. What we have is uranium. I don't care if we have inflation or deflation or huge economic growth or no economic growth. They are building 60 nuclear reactors around the world. When you spend billions on a nuclear reactor, you 3% of the cost is uranium. The supply has been insufficient for 12 years, insufficient from the mines. There's been plenty of secondary supplies coming out that have led to oversupply in the short term. But long term, the demand for uranium is going to bring the price, needs to triple to where people will open new mines. That's the incentive price. So we like that. Gold is not dependent upon the economy, and people can talk inflation, deflation. The price of gold goes up over time. Occasionally it has drops, but governments print money. That's what they do. The supply of gold is roughly fixed, going up 1%, 1.5% a year. As long as they print money more than that, arguably it could be go higher. Also, with or without inflation, the incentive price, we believe, to bring on new supplies is $2,000. If the economy is weak, if people say, oh, a deflationary collapse, that's the environment that people print money in. So we're not looking for, oh, CPI goes to 10. We don't care if there's any inflation or not inflation. We think that zero interest rate, maybe even negative interest rates, gold's been money for thousands of years. People can say this is inflation or deflation. They can say what they will, but when you're getting paid nothing to negative to hold money, which always in the history of mankind has lost value over time, somebody will choose to own gold. Right now, gold is 0.15% of the average portfolio. Maybe it's 0.2 after the recent run. What if 1% of the people choose to own gold versus zero? Maybe zero's an okay interest rate in a deflationary environment, but I don't think so. I think that maybe 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% of people might want to own gold. If they do, the supply's not going to go up. It has to be the price that's going to go up. So I believe that gold and uranium are not predicated on economic growth and not predicated on runaway inflation. They are scarce goods that demand arguably could overwhelm supply under any kind of environment. Over the last couple of months, we have started looking at everything else. We bought a little oil. We're looking at copper and iron and steel and oil. We're looking at all that thing now. They've gotten very, very cheap. When things get way below their incentive price, they eventually come back, whether there's inflation or deflation. So we own these things based on value, but we also find the prospective demand to be really good under any conceivable future scenario. Time will tell.
Yeah, along those lines, if I could get you to I don't know if I'd tempt you to answer this question. I hope I can. But if you know your front line, like in our position, where wealthy people you know have asked us to help steward their money, and you know, I'm not sure on the whole commodity side is, you know, what percentage of a you know the typical allocation you know do you think at this point tactically or you know permanently ought to be allocated to cap you know to commodities, and could I use your fund as a you know part of that allocation. I know that you guys over time have been flexible in that thinking, but if you were, you know, silly enough to be my partner and we were doing allocations for clients, is a 3% or 8%, and would that, does some of that need to be in directly in gold, or, you know, are there counterparty issues with ETFs? I'm just curious how you think of commodities and where that belongs in people's portfolios.
Yeah, as you know better than me, so much of it depends upon the client, so you need to,
sure,
to understand the client needs. However, it is interesting when the answer to a 30-day approach versus a 30-year approach could be quite the opposite. So,
no, I'm thinking it three to ten year. I'm not thinking short term.
Yes. All right. So even 3 to 10. I would say if somebody's looking at 1 year, I understand why they might want to hold some cash or if they have other needs. But if they're talking 3 to 10, especially if they're talking 10 years. Cash goes from looking pretty safe to looking like almost carelessly throwing away value. To lock something up for 10 years that's going to yield nothing, and to have central bankers have a goal of making it lose 2% of its value every year, that's a risky investment. So I think for people that have 3 to 10 year time horizons, then owning good business is the right price ought to be part of that. As to which businesses, there's a lot of reasons on a lot of businesses. What percent of them should be allocated in these businesses? If you look at our portfolio, I'm telling you that in 35 years, there's only been 3 times that I've been willing to put 25% into one business. And this is one of them. We think 25% is the right number to put in. Now, granted, we have more conviction than some people on those sort of things. But I think when you look at the yield on gold at zero and the yield on cash at zero, and you say which one of these is still going to have value 20 years from now, it's obvious gold's the better choice. In the next few months, it might be the other way. Maybe cash is, so I don't know. 25% is what we think is the right amount. But that's to each person's discretion. We also will point out that a lot of people feel safe owning close to what the benchmark has. A lot of times, that's the right choice. At important inflection points, that's a disastrous choice, and it's usually if and when people have a lot of money in gold, that'll be the time to take the money out. Back in 06 or 07, every meeting we had, people kept saying, oh, your index is 45% banks. Why don't you have 45% banks? Well, we had zero in financials. It seemed safe, only a lot of banks to people, but it wasn't. It's usually safer to buy something that's a small part of the index. So, we think that gold right now, I can't imagine why anybody would have less than 5%. I think everybody should have 5% of their money in gold. And we think 25 is the right number. Personally, I have more than that. But that requires people to have a long-term time horizon and be able to handle volatility relative to the dollar, but that's my answer, but it's a subjective thing. I'm not telling you it's the right answer.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
And that will conclude our conference for today. I'd like to thank everyone for your participation, and have a good day.